In India, Gandhi's birthday, October 2nd, is a holiday. But this year, 150 years since Gandhi was born, people are already celebrating his influence worldwide, and it is only August. In Kansas City, talks and celebrations started last night, and they're still going today. Gandhi was the leader of India's fight against British colonial rule, and he's become synonymous with his doctrine of nonviolent protest, a doctrine he used to gain freedom for his people despite the opposition of a truly powerful force, the British Empire. But even though this idea of nonviolent protest is what people think of when it comes to Gandhi, there's also Gandhi the person, and that's who I want to learn about from his grandson. He's here as part of Kansas City's celebration going on now. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Rajmu and Gandhi on KCUR's Central Standard. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
How was last night?
Last night was a great conversation at Park University, and we was focusing more on Gandhi the journalist, which he also was, among other things.
Yeah, that's super interesting to me. Yeah. This big symposium was making the case that Gandhi was the first peace journalist.
Yes. So fighting for peace. Of course, Gandhi and nonviolence are closely linked together. But his nonviolence, as is also true of, say, Martin Luther King's nonviolence, was also a fighting kind of nonviolence. You fought for justice, you fought for equality. And in that fight, Gandhi was, among other things, a very responsible journalist.
You are a professor in Illinois, and I wonder, as you meet new students, are they in disbelief when they find out that you are the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi?
They are curious. They're sometimes a little too respectful. Also, you know, as you can see, I'm a fairly old man. I'm now 84. So, soon there is a thaw, and then we are able to converse quite freely.
What was it like growing up with a grandfather who the whole world admired? Not that he had no opponents, but it's quite a legacy to live up to.
One doesn't try to live up to that kind of, certainly not those standards that he laid down and tried to live out. But there's also a positive side to it, because people are generally friendly to you. So that is a plus. It's also worth knowing that Gandhi was not a person who put family first. As far as he was concerned, all of India was his family. And he tried to give his time to so many other people. So rightly or wrongly, since family first was not his motto, it isn't as if his grandchildren, got too much time with him. For one thing, he was often in prison where the British put him. You know, again and again, he was for many years in prison. Or he was in different parts of India trying to put out fires of conflict between different groups in India. But when we did, his grandchildren, when we did meet him, he was amazingly affectionate and very warm.
Can you flesh that out for me a little bit more? What was it like?
In the old days, even now in some parts of India, when you meet a much older relative, a grandperson, a grandfather, grandmother, or an uncle or an aunt who is quite senior to you, the custom is to bow down. Sometimes you touch the feet of the revered person. Gandhi didn't want us to touch his feet, but we did bow down before him. And he would give a very big thump on the back, although he was an old man and he was often fasting, as some people may know. His thump had some strength, which I still remember.
Do you feel like your grandfather's name has come to represent an idea and that the human being can get lost in that?
Sure. But enough also has been written now about Gandhi, the human being. So those who have time to read or see some movies, they can know that he was also a very interesting human being, very warm. He could switch from being a tough fighter and a very serious writer to an extremely warm and a joke-making person.
You wrote a biography of your grandfather in the 1990s called The Good Boatman, A Portrait of Gandhi. And I've read just a little bit of it. The preface of that book is really touching and really fascinating. You start with this question people sometimes ask, whether your grandfather was a politician or a saint.
True. true, and I don't have a clear answer to that yet. He tried to be, although he never claimed that he was anywhere near being a saint, that certainly was his goal, a personal goal for him. But equally, it was his personal goal to liberate India. But you know, the process of liberating India from British rule was also a process of establishing equality between races, between different kinds of human beings. So that was not merely a political goal. There was something moral about it, ethical about it, even spiritual about it. So the political and the spiritual absolutely blended in Gandhi's struggle and life.
I'm interested that you also call him Gandhi.
Yes, because I'm a scholar. And apart from that book that you made reference to, years later, I wrote another big, large book, a very large book, which is a full biography of Gandhi. Yeah. So as a biographer, as somebody who's trying to study him as an individual of his time and place, I have to call him by his name without anything added before or after.
You know, you talk about the many conversations you have had with people in every arena in our world, people in politics, in the literary arts, in the academic world, you name it, who tell you what Gandhi meant to them.
Yes.
Can you talk to us about some of those conversations and how you synthesize all of that information? Because the way that your grandfather's, the idea of him lives in people's minds has had a profound influence.
I should mention that in 1957, when I was not yet fully 22, and Martin Luther King Jr. was 28, I had the chance to meet him in Washington, D.C. That same year, I also met his father, who was called Daddy King. And Martin Luther King Jr. was quite gentle, you might say, even passive at times when you met him face to face. His father was dynamic. He was militant. Of course, when Martin Luther King Jr. wrote or when he spoke, he was transformed into a visionary, into a fighter, into somebody who dreamt a powerful dream. I've met various other people, including Nelson Mandela, including the Dalai Lama, and many others, and people not so famous, who all have their impressions and memories or evaluations of Gandhi. And so it is, to me, quite remarkable that this man Gandhi, who, you know, when he was born and was a boy in a rustic corner of Western India, not one of the great cities of India, in those backwaters, he barely knew much of the English language. His access to information from the world or even from different parts of India was limited. How from that, and he was very shy, he was very diffident to begin with.
I believe you called him precocious. Do I remember that right?
Precocious.
Yeah.
He was precocious in some ways in his dreams, but he was not a very brilliant student in school. He was in the middle somewhere, neither at the very top nor at the bottom. But to me, it is an amazing story, and it's inspiring, encouraging to everybody that this shy, diffident person who was unsure of himself could then become so strong and so resolute and take on very large goals for himself.
Yeah, very large is, I would say, putting it mildly.
I agree.
I want to quote your words from this book. The reason that I picked this book is because it seems like it's one of your earliest attempts to sort of step back from your grandfather's life.
And try to understand him. Yeah.
So I want to quote your words from this book. You write, "I have marveled, but I have also been troubled. Gandhi wanted us to turn the searchlight inwards, and that is seldom wholly pleasant, for most of us hide unattractive corners. He disturbed in other ways, too. The lifestyle he prescribed seemed too severe, and some of his practices seemed strange. If I wanted to understand him fully, I also needed to face him fully." Rajmohan and Gandhi, what do you mean by that?
You know, there were his fasts. Sometimes he went on an indefinite fast, and he laid down certain conditions for his fellow Indians, Hindus, Muslims, so-called high castes, so-called untouchables, conditions that he wanted them to meet. And if they didn't meet them, he would extend his fast. These were unusual demands to make. Then he also had this desire to attain a state of perfect chastity, perfect purity. He took those injunctions in the great religions of the world, whether it was Christianity or Hinduism, about complete purity, freedom from lust, not only in action but in thought. And if you had a lustful thought in your mind, you had already committed adultery, that kind of notion. He took those very seriously. And some of the experiments he made to ensure that he was as chaste as he wanted to be were quite drastic and quite unusual. So those things obviously had to be faced, and these unusual and extremely strange practices also I had to look at and to try to understand.
What understanding did you come to for yourself?
I came to the understanding that Gandhi was so keen to affect his surroundings. He not only wanted India's liberation, he wanted equality in India. As you know, India is full of high caste and low caste notions, high and low notions. And these notions are carried out in an extreme manner. So Gandhi wanted to transform Indian society. And there was the Hindu-Muslim mistrust. He wanted to bridge that very wide gap. So in order to liberate India, to unite India, to create equality in India, he felt somehow that if he became absolutely perfect in terms of chastity, in terms of freedom from fear, freedom from the desire to acquire more money, if he became totally unselfish, in some ways, if he could become, in moral and ethical terms, a perfect person from his point of view, that then he could transform society. Or that, so.
Like almost by modeling on the individual level?
Partly that, but there's also a notion in Indian philosophy that a truly emancipated, enlightened, perfect human being then acquires the power to transform the world around him. So this too was, well, personally, I think that that is, I don't know, I don't want to judge his reasoning in such matters, but I would say that since most of us are people who, despite our best efforts, fall short even of our own goals, I myself feel that human perfection is not called for to change, help change society, but a human willingness to do whatever is right at any given point, that the Almighty can use even a weak person, an imperfect person, to change society. That is how I like to understand the world.
You have also wrestled with the fact that the subcontinent of India had not been freed of violence in your grandfather's lifetime, nor has it been today. And that was something he really wanted to see.
Absolutely right. And toward, you know, interesting that some of his American interlocutors, including some African-American interlocutors who went and met him in India, asked him, "You've been teaching nonviolence to India for 30 years and still so much violence?" And Gandhi accepted that that was the case. And one conclusion he drew from the reality was that although he had preached nonviolence to India, he had advocated freedom from fear and freedom from hate. And he said Indians found the doctrine of fear not attractive, but they did not find the doctrine of hate not attractive. And although many Indians refrained from violence, they were not willing to give up hatred. And this, to him, was the next step that Indians needed to take.
You know, you're giving this talk tonight on the importance of peace between India and Pakistan. Do you see that discussion as part of carrying on your grandfather Mahatma Gandhi's legacy?
Of course. That is, apart from being his legacy, it is a very deep concern, passion, goal for me, a dream for me, to bring about real reconciliation between Hindus and Muslims and between people of different religions, different races across the world. It's a very tough goal today. You know, some years ago, equality and mutual respect were popular, widely accepted global goals. But today, supremacy, let's take our country back, superiority. These seem to be goals. So I've taken on, along with many others, a difficult, necessary task.
Raj Mohan Gandhi, professor at the University of Illinois, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Raj Mohan Gandhi is Mahatma Gandhi's grandson. Park University has brought him to town for Gandhi's 150th birthday. He'll be speaking this evening at Johnson County Community College at 7 p.m. about peace building between India and Pakistan. Up next, a story about anything but peace, how the making of a famous cartoon mouse tore a friendship apart. Stay tuned. Mickey Mouse made his on-screen debut in 1928 with a black-and-white animated short film called Steamboat Willie. In this iconic short film, Mickey's working on a steamboat. He's whistling on the job when his big mean boss comes along and gives him what for. Mickey talks back. And from there, he gets into mischief of one kind and another in a plot that seems built to show off new tricks for animators, like when a goat swallows a guitar. And Mickey turns him into a music box. But the important thing about Steamboat Willie is that Mickey gets the last laugh. Steamboat Willie is a huge turning point in the story we've all been told about the birth of Mickey Mouse, who's been a household name in America since that movie came out. And the story of Mickey Mouse is not just the stuff of pop culture legend. It's part of Kansas City's whole mythology, because the man behind the mouse, Walt Disney, is from here. So what happens if the story of Walt Disney and Mickey Mouse as we know it is missing a few crucial details, namely the role of a major collaborator, a guy by the name of Ub Iwerks, also a Kansas Cityan, who never gets any credit for making Mickey. There's a new book about the whole sordid tale. It's called A Mouse Divided, and the author joins us now. Jeff Ryan, welcome to KCUR's Central Standard.
Thanks for having me, Gina.
So you realize, I assume, that the story, as it's been told, means a lot to Kansas City. Walt Disney is one of our major exports, and that is a point of local pride.
Yes, and what's one of the weird things about the story is that there's a big fan club at Disney called D23, which is the year that Disney left Kansas City. He spent so much time celebrating what he remembered from growing up in towns like Kansas City and Marceline. Main Street USA is like walking down a Missouri town from 100 years ago. But he never kept the connections to Kansas City that you would think he would have because he spent so much time celebrating it. And I think that reflects the fact that he also lost contact with his best friend and business partner, who was a Kansas Cityan too.
So we are going to get into details in a second, but tell the Cliff Notes version of the story. Who is Ub Iwerks and what was his role in creating Mickey Mouse?
Ub and Walt met on the job. They worked at an ad agency in 1919 or so. And that job lasted about 6 weeks, but they became best friends. And they created business after business in Kansas City, and they were trying to become animators. Ultimately, they succeeded with a cartoon called Alice in Cartoonland, where Alice was a live girl in a cartoon world, which no one had ever seen before. Walt pulls Ub over to Los Angeles. They make a whole bunch of these. Then they get tired of making Alice's, so they want to make just a pure cartoon. They make Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. Then Walt realizes that he doesn't own Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, and so they make Mickey Mouse, which Disney does own.
Okay.
And Mickey Mouse, of course, is Pop.
And we're going to get back into the details, like I said, but this book is hilarious. At least it is to me. Were you trying to be funny?
I attempted a little bit of humor. There's a lot of people who are a lot funnier than I am, but Mickey is a funny character, so I wanted to have some humor in there too.
I want to read a blurb from the back cover. This is what it says. Almost everything you know about Mickey Mouse is wrong. He wasn't Disney's first star. Steamboat Willie wasn't his first movie. Mickey wasn't a nice guy, and Walt Disney didn't invent him. It's so dramatic.
I tried to make it dramatic, too. So there's some laughs and there's some thrills as well.
Well, can you tell the story of how you came to investigate the Mickey Mouse story?
I had written a previous book about Super Mario, and the way Super Mario was successful was Nintendo copied the Mickey Mouse blueprint and did everything they could to put Mario's face wherever it went, so when you saw one, you thought of the other. And I wanted to know how Disney made that in the first place, because I'm a pretty voracious pop culture devourer, but I had only seen 1.5 Mickey Mouse cartoons, and most people I talked to felt the same way. How can this be? How can the most popular fictional character in the world be someone that no one is a fan of and no one knows anything about?
Well, so talk a little bit more about that, first of all, the connection between Super Mario and Mickey Mouse, because that is pretty interesting.
Mickey was the first true global star. He was I called him the first second generation star because all of his cartoons were parodies in a sort of other cartoons, of other stories. Like Steamboat Willie is a parody of a popular Buster Keaton film, popular at the time, called Steamboat Bill Jr. People don't remember Steamboat Bill Jr. anymore, but they remember Steamboat Willie. They remember the parody.
And so can you connect the dots between that and Super Mario?
The connection, I would say, is that Mickey was so popular that everyone wanted to take part in anything that Mickey was a part of. And Nintendo realized the same thing. So if they were making a racing game, they would put Super Mario in there. If they were making a tennis game, they would put Super Mario in there. If they were making an exploring game, they'd put Mario in there. He became their everything.
But he also doesn't. Yeah, he also doesn't have an actual story or real like character in the way we think of characters. And that is something I never thought of before about Mickey Mouse. You write how he's this universally beloved character who has no real character. Like, who is Mickey Mouse? What is his backstory? You know, what does he want? Yeah. What does he need? We have no idea. He's just this big head with two big circles for ears.
And when I went back to watch the original Mickey Mouse cartoons, I realized that there were actually two different Mickey Mouses, depending upon who was in the driver's seat. Walt Disney's version of Mickey Mouse and Noob Iwerks' Mickey were totally different. Walt's idea was the everyman, sort of what you think of for Charlie Chaplin, the guy who was a friend to everyone and just wanted to help out. And Oob had a different idea. Oob wanted to make an action-adventure star. He wanted to copy Douglas Fairbanks and Zorro. So that was his idea of Mickey, the mouse of action. And you think those two characters really don't go together. But because they went back and forth telling the story, they did. Mickey became both the aw shucks everyman and the man of action who would charge in and save the day.
Can you give an example of where we see those two different Mickeys that people might be familiar with?
You can see both Mickeys in Steamboat Willie when he's whistling and tuning the steamboat down. That's the Walt Disney Mickey, and that's why that image shows up in front of all of the Disney films. But then when he takes a shot at Pete, and I think he kicks him in the butt, something like that, that is Oob's Mickey Mouse coming in.
So I want to get to the newly revised story that you tell of Mickey Mouse, the story of his creation as you understand it, where Mickey is actually the result of a collaboration between Walt Disney and Oob Iwerks. Can you get us up to the point where they have created a character named Oswald the Rabbit and what that moment, where that moment leaves them as a creative duo?
They've created Oswald, and they were making about $1,800 for each Oswald. Walt goes to Universal, his distributor, over in New York, and says, hey, I want a raise. And the distributor says, we're not going to give you a raise. We're going to cut your salary per Oswald cartoon by about $500 because we have hired all of your animators out from under you. We think that you are a weak link in the chain of Disney animation, that you don't do anything other than recycle old jokes. We can do that better than you can. And Walt was really flummoxed by this, partly because he had been warned about it. When Universal called all of his animators, they called Ub Iwerks. Ub was the only one who stood by Walt Disney and said, no, I'm not leaving my best friend. He brings more to this company than you realize.
So who is Oswald the Rabbit, though? Can you describe that character?
Oswald is basically Mickey Mouse, except he has two long ears instead of two round ears. The characters are almost identical in appearance, but Disney lost the rights to Oswald in 1928. And then they gained them back in 2006 because Disney's a much bigger company now. And it made a deal with NBC, which was owned by Universal at the time. They traded the rights to Oswald the Lucky Rabbit for Al Michaels appearing on Sunday Night Football.
Whoa. So back to the 1920s, though. Walt Disney and Ub Iwerks decide to stand together. They don't need anyone else. They're going to create their next new character on their own, and they're going to own it. The birth of Mickey Mouse comes next. And in your book, you reference an episode of Drunk History on Comedy Central that tells the story. So I looked that up, and I want to play a clip now, and then you can elaborate and possibly correct a few details. Derek Miller is the drunk narrator of this story, and the clip picks up after the Oswald the Rabbit fiasco.
Well, it's like, we need a character up. What do you got? What about a horse? Nope. What about a dog? Nope. What about a cat? No, man, we got enough cats. We got Felix the cat. There's a lot of cats out there. What else you got? What about a mouse? Walt's like, yeah, let's do that. But what happened next was all Ub Iwerks, okay? So Ub locked himself in the studio, and he churns out 600 to 700 frames a day. Unheard of. He did 2 months of animation in 2 weeks, and he created a character, Mickey Mouse. He sat down and drew that cartoon, plain crazy. Walt loves it, but he goes, you know what? We need something bigger. And Ub was like, what if we could sync sound to it? What if we did our next cartoon where we could see the action happening in the time with the music? And Walt was like, yeah, let's do sync sound. So Steamboat Willie comes out, and it blows audiences away. They went, I can see that mouse whistling. I can hear the mouse whistling. Oh my God, this mouse is whistling along with what his mouth is doing. This f***ing sync sound.
So that is the drunk history version of how Ub Iwerks and Walt Disney both created Mickey Mouse.
That was excellent.
Okay,
one thing I'd say that wasn't totally accurate is that sync sound was Walt's idea, not Ub's. Walt was in New York, and he learned about a soundtrack system, and he knew that a gimmick would sell the Mickey Mouse cartoon, so sound was going to be the gimmick.
Okay, so point of clarification, is it Ub or Ub?
Officially, it's Ub, but Walt said Ub, therefore everyone else said Ub.
Man, this guy's name was even stolen.
Yeah, it's Frisian, which is a tiny little language that came out of Germany.
Okay, but let's elaborate on the story that we just heard the drunken version of. I mean, first of all, this issue of, like, they're just sitting there floundering for a character, but is this real? Like, they knew that they need a cartoon animal. It's got to be an animal.
Yes, and they did cycle through not just a bunch of animals, but all of the animals that that the drunk narrator mentioned. And those all show up in the first Mickey Mouse cartoon, Plain Crazy. There's a cow, there's a horse, there's a turkey that wanders by. So Ub was very economical. All those characters he designed, he put to use right away.
And he really drew all of them.
He drew every single frame. What's even more remarkable was that all of the other Disney animators had given their 2 weeks' notice, so he was doing this in the office in secret while everyone else was drawing the final Oswald the Lucky Rabbit cartoon.
Man, so, I mean, it's pretty intense. The idea of a collaboration, you know, you kind of imagine, Walt, it sounds like, is the visionary, and he's, like, the driving force. In some ways, more than he's the creator.
Yes, he's the spark plug and Ub is the engine. And that became abundantly clear when they went their separate ways a year later, because Ub was able to produce a tremendous amount of animation of incredibly high quality, very inexpensively, but it never sang to people the way that Walt Disney's animation did. And Walt was able to replace Ub with other great animators who could stand on his shoulders, but Ub could never replace Walt.
Because you do need a visionary.
Yes, you do. You do need something to say in your story.
So, but, okay, what goes wrong with this? Because in some ways, it does sound like the perfect pairing of this person who has this incredible ability to draw well, draw quickly, and really there is a brilliance in Mickey Mouse that you write about that is largely visual, a visual brilliance of these, basically, like I said, three circles, head, ear,
yes.
Ear.
And they'd been working together for 10 years without any true success. And this is their success. This is their moment when they should be reveling and enjoying it. But the stress of it affected them differently. It affected Walt particularly, where he took all of his anger out on Ub. His wife called it the Disney disposition. It was something that Walt's father had and his brother had. And people in the Disney family yelled and screamed at each other, and then on the turn of a dime, they stopped and they felt better because they had expressed their emotion. And they never needed to apologize because no one did in the family growing up. So Ub wasn't used to that. He got all of this abuse after a year and decided, I'm doing most all of the work here. I'm going to leave. You can hire other people to make your own cartoons. I'm going to make my own because I don't want to be yelled at anymore.
Jeff Ryan, my guest, has dug deep into the Walt Disney Mickey Mouse story for his new book, A Mouse Divided, which explores the forgotten efforts of Walt's collaborator, who, by the way, was also a Kansas Cityan. We'll have more of this conversation about the true origins of that famous mouse in just a minute. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're talking about Walt Disney's forgotten collaborator, Ub Iwerks, also a Kansas Cityan. Author Jeff Ryan wrote a book about their relationship and how Disney remembered them.
They have all of these celebrations for Mickey Mouse, and everyone talks about how Walt Disney created Mickey Mouse, but he had help. There was someone else who physically drew Mickey Mouse and drew every frame of the first appearance and was Walt Disney's business partner, too. When Ub left Disney, he had a 20% stake in the company. He sold it for $3,000.
Man.
Do you want to know how much he'd be worth if he stuck around?
If he I do want to know.
I'll be yelled at by Walt. He'd be worth $32 billion.
The cost of abuse is high.
Yeah. Yeah. But at the time, he thought that he could just make another fortune. He didn't know that Mickey was going to be it.
Or that, I mean, it sounds like maybe both of them didn't quite recognize the value of the other or fully acknowledge it?
I think you're right, yeah. And they only realized when they went their separate ways. When people would ask where Mickey Mouse came from, Walt couldn't tell the truth. He couldn't say, oh, my best friend made him up and he's not around anymore because I yelled at him too much. So he made up the story, which got bigger and bigger in the retelling, that first he invented it on the train going to Los Angeles. Then his wife helped. Then there was a flashback scene involving mice that he kept as pets. Then there was a pen pal where he drew Mickey Mouse to a little girl that he was friends with. The story just kept bigger and bigger. And he was a great storyteller, so it was a great story. But he would always wink when he was telling it. Like, you know, you want to believe this one? Because it was covering up the heartbreak underneath.
Let's hear from Sunny calling us from Overland Park. Hi, Sunny.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to share?
Well, I have a little information going back to Walt's early years. My uncle had a commercial art studio in Kansas City, and he employed Walt and I believe to do animation. His job was to create these slides that used to appear between double feature films, you know, advertising slots. Anyway, as the story goes, this is a family heritage, this story. As the story goes, it was just before Christmas time, and they had my uncle had lost a certain account that was most of their business, so he had to let some people go, and he let Walt go. And in later years, they maintained a friendship. There was no animosity there. In later years, after jumping way ahead, after Walt had become famous, my uncle had retired to California, and Walt offered him a tour of the facility. And as the story goes, Walt kind of obliquely offered him a position there of some sort, he said. And my uncle told him, he said, Walt, I'd be as out of place here as you were in my place in Kansas City.
This is a great story.
I have a picture in my possession taken in Walt's office with Walt, my uncle, and Ub Iwerks. And it is signed by Walt Disney to Lou Pessman.
This is great.
My first job in the art world.
Sonny, thank you. Jeff Ryan, you know, I'm sure that, like, you talk about this book in a lot of places. Talking about it to Kansas Cityans is a little different.
This is great. Someone who was a descendant from the owners of the Pessman Rubin Studio called in. That's amazing.
So you are dismantling a creation story, the creation story of Mickey Mouse, or at least you're adding a whole person to that story, which makes Walt Disney more of a partner in Mickey's creation than the guy who gets all the credit. And you mention in your book that you didn't come to this as someone with any special love of the Disney lore. Can you talk to me about your relationship with Disney just as a person living in this world?
Okay. It wasn't that much of a relationship. I'm from a big family. We have four kids, and we never went to Disney World growing up. And I watched the Disney Channel a little bit, but I never saw any Mickey Mouse cartoons. So I didn't have that love ingrained that so many people do for Disney and the Disney Empire. I never saw Mary Poppins as a kid. I never all of the big Disney touch points I wasn't part of. So I wanted to learn about that. I wanted to see what everyone else loved about Disney. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote this book.
So you're like, you're in some ways almost this anthropologist looking at what for most people would be like part of American culture, but for you just wasn't. It wasn't part of your frame of reference.
It wasn't part of my childhood growing up, but it was part of the American childhood. And I felt like I missed out on it. I wanted to see what I missed out on.
And so you did a lot of work in the Disney archives, or you tried to. It turns out that the Disney archives, like getting in there is almost like getting FBI clearance or something.
Yes. A lot of people want to get into the Disney vault, which is a very big, not quite organized place. So they only let people who have been researching for a very long time or are working for Disney, making something like a DVD extra. So I wasn't allowed in, but I found the next best thing, something possibly even better, which was that there was an unpublished biography of Walt Disney that was written the year after he died by a man named Richard Hubler. And this was an authorized book, but when the family read it, they said, we don't want this to go out into the world. We don't want this to be the picture of Walt. So what happens to authorized books when the family that authorizes it doesn't like it is it never comes out. So there's one copy that exists in the Disney archives, and I'm never going to read that one. But I found another one. There was another one in the Richard Hubler papers that he donated to Boston University. So I drove up to Boston for a couple of days, and I had to wear white gloves while I was reading it because these are archived documents at this point. So I was cosplaying as Mickey Mouse while I was researching Mickey Mouse.
That is pretty funny. I mean, you've taken your you have dug deeper into Mickey Mouse as someone who technically wasn't obsessed than a lot of people who have been obsessed in sort of, I don't want to say an age-appropriate way, because lots of adults are also obsessed with Mickey Mouse, but like Mickey Mouse is a children's character, but you are like the grown-up who's like, I'm going to try and get this now.
Yes, I'm in my 40s and I'm writing about a character who shows up on kindergartners' backpacks. I realize that there's not many people who are doing that.
Can we talk, though, about what you see in this as someone looking at it from the outside that a fan might miss?
One thing I think a fan might miss is that Mickey changed over the years. He evolved. He was not a very nice guy at the beginning. There's stuff that goes on in his first cartoon, Plane Crazy, which Disney cuts out nowadays. Even in Steamboat Willie, there's a minute of footage that they cut out normally when they reshow it because Mickey Mouse wants to play on an orchestra of animals.
But oh, I saw that version.
It's not done in a friendly way. It's done in a way where he's torturing these poor animals.
He's pulling their tails.
Yes, he's pulling their tails and he's kicking them.
I was really alarmed.
Them. Yeah, that's what passed for humor back then, back when a lot of people had animals in their backyard and they were much more cavalier. There was no ASPCA back then.
Well, then how did Mickey change? Do you see like a Mickey turning point?
Bit by bit, people would write letters in saying, I'm a parent and my kids are acting like Mickey Mouse. You've got to knock this off. And so Walt decided to smooth off Mickey's rough edges to make him look as round as his silhouette does. And he had other animators who helped out with that in the post-Ub years. And that created the Mickey Mouse that we know and love. But that also made it very hard to tell stories about Mickey Mouse because Mickey could no longer get angry at anything because he wasn't a regular person with regular emotions. Enter a certain duck in the Disney archives who is well known for being extremely angry, Donald Duck. All of the stories they couldn't tell with Mickey, they could tell with Donald because Donald was rage personified.
Well, why is it okay for Donald but not okay for Mickey? I don't get it. That didn't bother parents that the duck was mad?
I guess it didn't bother them because Donald Duck isn't heralded as a good example. No one wants to be like Donald Duck when they grow up. But Mickey is everyone's friend. Donald is like the drunk uncle in the corner who's being told, you can't smoke the cigar in here. And he's like, it's okay. I'm blowing the smoke outside. And they're like, oh, Uncle Donald.
And then the Mickey Mouse Club. I mean, by the time that's in effect and Mickey's saying his whole name is M-I-C-K-E-Y-Y because I love you, then he has to be nice, right?
Yeah, then he has to be nice. And the Mickey Mouse Club, which wasn't the one in the 50s with Doreen and Annette and Cubby and the hats, that wasn't the first Mickey Mouse Club. The first one was a promotion to get kids to watch Mickey Mouse. They would get something like a punch card. And when they got 10 punches, they got a special Mickey Mouse book. And the prizes that they got for attending all the Mickey Mouse Clubs kept changing. So you kept having to go back again and again to get all of the new prizes. And you could go to shops in town that had orange placards up that said, we support the Mickey Mouse Club, and you could get extra punches that way. And that's really strange to think about because the local drugstore is not just supporting the local movie theater, but it's supporting the short that's running before the feature in the movie theater. That it goes backwards two or three different ways because it's advertising supporting other advertising.
That seems very prescient, actually. I mean, that's kind of the world we now live in.
Exactly. Mickey Mouse was the first citizen of the 21st century, way back when.
Do you also write about him as a religious figure, which I find fascinating.
It's mostly because we are, as a culture, as a society, as a species, we look to higher powers. And starting in the 20th century, fewer and fewer people went to church or synagogue. And the need for some sort of iconography was still there. And that's where Mickey Mouse came in. And we could worship him the same way that we worshiped a saint. Think about this. Look around your house and count how many images of Mickey Mouse and other Disney characters you have. And then compare it to how many people, how many representations of your religion that you have, what your belief system is. Mickey Mouse is probably going to win. If you're just looking at it from the pile of one versus a pile of another, there's more Mickey Mouse stuff in your house than what you say you believe in for spirituality.
And then also just the fact that Mickey Mouse's silhouette is this symbol that we recognize just immediately, that the meaning behind it is left a little bit open-ended, you know?
Right. That's one of the great things about icons. You don't need to know what it represents. It represents something a little different to everyone. But so long as you put it up and you have a positive feeling, it doesn't matter if everyone's feelings don't overlap in a perfect Venn diagram. It's easier if the Venn diagrams are a little separated. And I realize once again, I'm now describing the silhouette of Mickey Mouse by talking about what the Venn diagrams look like.
Well, so... okay, we've gotten pretty deep here in the whole Mickey Mouse story, but I want to get back to the story that started this whole conversation, the story of Walt Disney and Ub Iwerks, his collaborator, the collaborator who's been largely forgotten. We have a call from Mike in Lee's Summit all about Ub. Hi, Mike.
Hey.
Welcome to the show.
Hey, Mike.
Thanks. Hey. I've known about Ub for a while because he's a alumni of Northeast High School, the same high school I went to, and that he's one of the famed, I guess, alumni of Northeast, and that I went to Northeast, but my dad went to Westport, the same high school that Walt went to in the same time. He didn't know Walt Disney, but it's kind of a coincidence there. And that the other thing is that Walt has, why the UMKC Kangaroos are called Kangaroos is that when UMKC was the University of Kansas City, Walt drew a cartoon kangaroo, and that's why UMKC are now known as the Roos.
Huh. Okay, Mike.
Wow.
Thank you so much for calling in. Mike also has a family connection, not just to one of these characters, but to both of these characters. Can you talk about, first of all, some of the early, more of that early relationship between Walt Disney and Ub Iwerks? We've heard about what happened when they were in L.A. How did their friend, they met at an animation studio here?
It was
an
art studio.
Okay.
Yes. And they had a dream not of making animation, but of making a comic strip because Kansas City is where so much of the syndication for newspapers was. So they wanted to pitch it to King Feature Syndicate. And they had mocked up fake newspaper pages to make it look like that their comic strip had already been published elsewhere. And King was just going to pick it up. And that ended up not happening. 10 years later, though, they did get a chance with King, of all places, to make a Mickey Mouse daily comic strip. And they worked together on it. This was during 1929 when everything was falling apart relationship-wise. So they only had a couple of weeks together.
Also economically.
Yes. Yes. Well, it's one more coincidence or irony that Disney did great all throughout the Great Depression because it never invested in anything other than its own company. And people always had a nickel or a dime to go to the movie theater.
Wow. So that brings me to my next question, which is whatever happened to Ub? We basically know what happened to Walt Disney and his name, but what happened to Ub later in life?
That's one of the reasons I really wanted to tell this story, because in most Disney histories, Ub Iwerks disappears when he leaves Disney and you never hear what happens to him. So I wanted to find out. And what happened was he became one of Walt's competitors and he went to one of the people who helped rip Walt off back in the day, Pat Powers. And working together, Ub almost tried to topple Walt Disney, and he succeeded for about a year, and then he ran out of money, and his cartoons went from color to black and white, and then the quality went down, and people stopped caring because Disney was able to put more money and more care into their product, and there was a better story being told at Disney than at Iwerks' studio.
Does Ub have any fans? Does he have, like, a following, a secret cult following?
He has a massive cult following. In fact, there's a very popular video game from the last couple of years called Cuphead, where all of the characters are drawn in 1930s-style animation, and all of that is directly pulled from Ub Iwerks.
Jeff Ryan is the author of A Mouse Divided, How Ub Iwerks Became Forgotten and Walt Disney Became Uncle Walt. We spoke in December, and that's a wrap for today's show. Tomorrow, we'll talk with the author of a new book about Emmett Till. If there's something on your mind that you think we ought to be discussing, talk to us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. And join us for a storytelling event this Thursday at the Record Bar. There's info at kcur.org. It's going to be really great. I'm serious. Don't miss it. It's all stories about the working life on the job this Thursday at the Record Bar. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rao with Ann Kinnegendorf and Aviva Okeson-Haberman. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.